Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. What a gorgeous day out there. It's a beautiful day in an imperfect world. There's a bunch of topics that I want to get to today, starting with gun control. A lot of activity on gun control, especially in D.C., and I want to get to that and ask the question, do we have enough gun control or do we need more? Also, I want to get to the point of discussing a question that I have that asks, what are the qualities you learned from your father that made a difference in your life? And the reason we're asking that is Father's Day is coming up, and tomorrow's show is pretty jam-packed, so what I want to do is try to bring up these issues of why your father made a difference in your life. I think it's important to discuss. And then later on, we'll speak with Kate Payne, a social media expert, on tips you should know to enhance your presence on social media for jobs, if you're a job seeker, and your business. And Kyle Madura from Channel 3 News, WCAX, will join us for an update on the Senator Norm McAllister trial happening in Highgate. But what I wanted to start out with this morning is just to mention this horrible tragedy that happened in Orlando, Florida, where the two-year-old was snatched by an alligator and dragged into the water and was killed. This happened at a Disney Resort hotel. You know, I don't know why this story hit me the way that it did, but it had a profound impact on me. Especially when you think about the other two senseless incidents of violence in Oregon or in Orlando over the weekend, where others, and many more actually, of innocent people died in those tragedies. But the two-year-old, a two-year-old is the epitome of innocence, and perhaps that brought home the point of just how savagely killed innocent people were over the weekend and how they died, how brutally they died. And maybe through a two-year-old, we discovered just how precious life is and how it can be so suddenly taken away. And that these cases, all of these cases, whether it's the two-year-old, whether it's the shootings in the nightclub in Orlando, whether it's the shooting of a pop star, these were cases that were no fault of their own. They just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. The death of the two-year-old, at least to me, breaks my heart, but it should remind us that all the events in Orlando should break our hearts in the same way. Be interested in your thoughts, if you have any, on the tragedies in Orlando. But let's start out with gun control. Do we need more? Do we have enough? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Just swing around the horn on some of the events that are happening. I'll get to the events that are happening in Congress. But today's Rutland Herald's editorial, Rutland Herald Times Argus editorial, concludes with this. The gun lobby has created an atmosphere of hysteria around the idea of gun regulation, as if the slightest compromise of the right to bear arms imperils the republic and the right of man. What imperils the republic is carnage accounting to about 27 people shot dead every day. In 2 days, we exceeded the toll of Orlando. It appears after the murders of Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, that the nation's gun culture would allow for compromises sufficient to create modest protections for innocent children. But the fears of politicians for their own careers exceeds their concern of the lives of American people. Americans live under siege and still have not found a way out. That's the editorial in the Rutland Herald Times Argus entitled Under Siege. And just to bring it up to speed, there was a filibuster by Senator Chris Murphy. He is a Democrat from Connecticut, and he was filibustering wanting gun control to come to a vote in the U.S. Senate. And by the way, he got his way. We'll talk about that in a minute. Senator Leahy of Vermont joined that filibuster. Leahy advocated for what he called common sense gun laws. He called for universal effective background checks and regulating assault rifles. I don't want to even think about how many Americans, though I do every day, have been killed, Leahy said. I consider myself a responsible gun owner, but I think it's common sense that if we have assault weapons that are designed for the battlefield, they really have no place on our streets, in our schools, in our churches, or in our communities. Just for clarification, the assault rifles that are on the battlefield aren't the same rifles that are for gun sale. Those on the battlefield can be switched to fully automatic if they're an assault rifle. The ones on that are sold in gun stores that are knockoffs look alike, but they can only be semi-automatic like any other hunting rifle or anything like that. So the question I have is, do we need more gun control in this country? Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic.
Yes, September the 11th, 3,000 Americans died, and there wasn't one gun involved in those deaths. Mm-hmm. And the way this is being wrapped around is this is terror. They're using terror. And the law that they want to pass is anybody on a no-fly list and terror watch can't purchase a gun. I want to know, why is that guy my neighbor? Mm-hmm. If he's on a no-fly list and a terror watch, what's he doing living in my neighborhood? Mm-hmm. It's not a gun problem. We have laws. Like you said, there's no such thing as an assault rifle being sold here. It's a rifle. And I think what certain groups of people are doing is they're wrapping themselves in tragedies and trying to make it their mantra. We had the UN tell the United States that we're savages because we allow our people to own weapons. Mm-hmm. Once again, it is a society of the Nazis and the social the Soviets. That the first thing they do is they do take away your weapons, so you can't stand up for yourself.
Let me ask this question, Sam, and let's take the no-fly list off this. I actually was on the no-fly list for a little while. I don't know why. I had to go through a whole bunch of paperwork.
It would be your show.
Sam, would you agree that a terrorist or somebody that's identified as a terrorist should not be able to pass a background check?
Background check? I can't figure out why they're here. This is the part of, if you're a terrorist, I mean, why aren't you locked up?
Mm-hmm. Or suspected. I mean, there probably would not be, in this case, in Orlando, he was suspected of terrorism, but he never showed up on any sort of list that prohibited him from buying a gun.
I think that's by design. I think this administration has made this by design. The same scenario that happened out in the islands with the sheriff's department pulling over a car with a person in the car, and the way this is being reported is they profiled him because he looked like he was Mexican. They could have profiled him because he didn't speak English and he didn't have any kind of identification on him.
Thanks, Sam. Let's go to D in Duxbury. D, you're on open mic. Should we have more gun control laws, D?
Well, I think it's good to think about the specific cases, like you're talking about Sandy Hook or what happened in Florida. These people, the people that committed the crimes that shot the kids or the adults in the nightclub or whatever, they hadn't committed a crime. They weren't on any list. You know, as a matter of fact, the guy who shot the kids in Sandy Hook, his mother bought him the gun. You know, what are you going to do? I mean, we do have laws, but what are you going to do in those cases where you're not a criminal till you commit a crime?
Thanks, Dee. Let's go to Bill in Johnson. Bill, you're on open mic, and we're discussing gun control. Should there be more laws on gun control?
Mike, I'm going to say something unpopular, so get ready.
Yep.
We have gun control in the United States called the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is a two-part system of protecting against tyranny, both from domestic terrorists or burglars or criminals, and from the government itself. The idea, anything that truly inhibits or substantially inhibits the Second Amendment freedoms, as which, by the way, the courts have incorporated under the 14th Amendment to impose on the states, anything that imposes substantial restrictions against those is basically saying it's okay for the government to be heavily armed, but the citizenry should not. Now, this is unpopular. When my grandfather was in World War I, the bolt-action rifle was the assault weapon of its day. Today, the AR-15 type semi-automatic rifle is, quote, the assault weapon of our day. The term assault weapon is a misnomer. It is politically charged. It comes from a German manufacturer called Sturmgewehr, which was an automatic weapon. So when anyone, including yourself, repeats the term assault weapon instead of saying semi-automatic rifle, you don't refer to people who own a semi-automatic pistol as owning a police-type pistol, even though every cop in the country's got a Glock.
Or a military.
So we have to stop perpetuating the term assault weapon, first of all, and we need to open our eyes to the intent of the Second Amendment, which is to protect the people from crime and domestic terrorism. At the time would have been, for instance, maybe Indian raids or French-Canadian, you know, criminals, trappers. I don't know what it was, but they had a perception that we needed to protect it from criminals. But their primary goal was as a bulwark against tyranny. That the government should not be more armed than the people is a basic premise for freedom and democracy.
Thank you, Bill. Let's go to Bill in Barry. The question we're asking is, should we have more gun control in this country? Bill from Barry, go right ahead.
First, I want to say this. Everybody in my neighborhood that I know, who I know, has a gun. And when when those two killers escaped from Dannemora, everybody in my neighborhood felt safer because we all had a weapon. And we're hunters and stuff like that, been in the service, done all that. So we know how to use guns. And it gave me a sense of security and people here. And I've always had a gun. I learned when I was 7 years old. The point is that it's who. And when you were talking about if you're not allowed on a flight list or something like that, I do think that there's nothing wrong with somebody who is mentally ill, who could conform, could be a threat, to not be allowed to purchase a gun. But I want to go further and say this. If that killer had not been allowed to purchase a gun legally, and this may be a question, isn't it true that he could have found either another way to do his carnage, like bombs, or get a gun illegally?
Sure, Bill. I think there's always the possibility that he can do harm in another way. And it's always the case that strict gun control laws don't prevent, sometimes don't prevent these. Look at Paris and France in accordance to what happened there. So, you know, those, the, your question, the answer is yes, it can happen any place. I want to come back to this subject because we've had so many calls. The passions are running deep. I do want to come back to this subject. I also want to talk about Father's Day coming up in this hour because we're going to be crammed for time in the second hour as well. But I also want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about what's happening up in Highgate. And there's a trial going on in Highgate with Senator Norm McAllister. He's being accused of several very, very serious crimes, and I want to check in with Kyle Madura. We did the other day, check in with him and get the latest on what's happening in that trial. Good morning, Kyle.
Morning, Mike. How are you today?
Good, thank you. Of course, we're speaking with Kyle Madura from WCAX News. Kyle, can you give us an update of what happened yesterday?
So yesterday, there were a few fights that went on for a little bit regarding cameras in the courthouse, media access, but once that was out of the way, ultimately, opening arguments went fairly quickly from both the state as well as the defense, and immediately moved right into the first witness, and this, of course, is the accuser. She spent the bulk of the day on the stand, and whether the jury believes her stories or not will really be the crux of this case. Much of the state's case relies on her testimony. She spoke in graphic detail about multiple instances of alleged sexual assault by Senator McAllister. The defense, when they got her on cross-examination, really tried to call her credibility into question. They called, they focused on aspects of her timeline where it didn't make sense with other elements. So, for instance, at one point she mentioned that she had purple hair. They pulled up a Facebook post and said, well, it appears you had purple hair at this time, which is different from when you described. They called out inconsistencies in her sworn depositions, inconsistencies between those depositions and what she ultimately said on the stand. So it'll be interesting to see which way the jury reads these things, because she was not necessarily she didn't come across as the most hurt victim you would see on the stand. At times she was quite feisty with both the defense counsel as well as even the state's attorney at points, and didn't really seem to want to be there. So it's going to come down to whether the jury believes the version of events she told on the stand, because those versions do slightly differ from, and at some points substantially differ from what she said under oath.
Now, the defense is presenting its case. When do you expect the defense to rest? Is she the only witness the defense is calling?
The defense has not begun its case. We're still in the state's
case. I'm sorry, Kyle. The prosecution, is she the only witness the prosecution is calling?
No, there once and right now we are not through her testimony. So yesterday ended rather abruptly in the middle of the defense's first cross-examination of the witness. That cross-examination, when we get going again here this morning, we are delayed a little bit, will begin again. At that point, we do expect redirects, so the state will ask questions again, probably another recross, and that will continue for some amount of time. It's unclear. It might take us right up to noon, might even go beyond, but we do expect each one of those to get shorter and shorter and shorter. Once that's all said and done, the bulk of the state's case is over. They'll be going, and they'll call police officers. They may call a couple of the lawmakers who roomed with Senator McAllister in the legislative session, and they may actually call to the witness stand the accuser in Senator McAllister's other pending case, which still doesn't have a trial date. She was also at the farm. She may have walked in on one of these alleged instances of sexual assault. So we expect to see them. Then I believe the defense's case is going to depend on how well they perceive the state to have made its case. So there's a possibility they call the lieutenant governor's chief of staff to talk about what the intern was like, what she talked about. Allegedly, she may have discussed issues with her boyfriend, but not issues with Senator McAllister. Representative Corey Perrin may be called by the defense as well. He is said to have driven the accuser in this case to Montpelier on a number of times. It will be, I think their case is going to depend in large part on how well they believe the state has made its case.
Do you get any indication as you look at the jury about the impact of various things that are being said on the stand or in reaction to the defense attorney's questions?
You certainly see reaction in the moment, but it's hard to tell if that is something that is sustained. And, of course, it takes 12 people in agreement, guilty or not guilty, in order to get a judgment. And so at any given time, you might see different looks of surprise. But until the jury, once it ultimately goes to its deliberations, until the jury is completely on the same page, they won't have an official decision. And therefore, it's hard to extrapolate any given moment, any given testimony, and say, oh, yeah, they're all sold this way or they're all sold that way. I don't think it is something that we can really glean much from other than a momentary reaction to an individual bit of testimony.
We're speaking with Kyle Madura, WCX reporter, and we're talking about the trial of Senator Norm McAllister, who's been charged with sexual assault. Is the trial going on longer than we expected?
Well, there have been a few delays. So yesterday there was about a two-hour delay because there were differences of opinion on whether broadcast outlets like our own would be able to get video recordings, audio recordings as the accuser took the stand. Ultimately, the judge ruled that we could have audio but would not be allowed video. It is our policy, generally speaking, not to identify victims. So we might have had video of their hands or of Senator McAllister listening to the testimony. But the judge did rule that we would be limited to audio. So we found ways to make that work. That was a slight delay. This morning we're delayed because we're told that a key person has not arrived. It's unclear who that person is. The accuser is here. We believe the whole jury is here, so we're not totally sure who that person is, but right now we are in a holding pattern as we wait. That, of course, means this could go longer. Right now the cross-examination of the accuser has gone longer than many may have anticipated. We also expect the defense to spend a fair amount of time cross-examining police, as they argue that this investigation was not thorough enough. So it's quite possible that this trial does drag into a third day. If it is going to finish today, the case would have to go to the jury by 4:30. They'd be allowed to deliberate until 9 p.m. So it's possible it wraps today, but it's also quite possible this goes at least an additional day longer than was initially anticipated.
Two reporters were subpoenaed, Kyle, a 7 Days reporter and a VPR reporter. Are they going to be testifying?
Yesterday they were released without having to take the stand. At this point in time, I believe they will not have to testify. VPR did provide an audio recording of one conversation. I'm not sure what was worked out with the 7 Days reporter, if anything, but we are told that neither will be taking the stand.
Last question, any chance Norm McAllister himself will take the stand?
I think that's going to depend, again, on whether the defense believes the state has made its case. We asked ahead of the trial whether the senator would be taking the stand. We were told you'll have to wait and see, and up to this point, nothing has changed in that regard. Would imagine he would either be the first or last witness for the defense if he were to take the stand. But until they start making their case, we'll just have to wait to find out.
Kyle Madura of CAX News. Kyle, thank you very much for spending some time. I know it's a busy day. I thank you for spending some time with us.
Absolutely, Mike. Have a great day.
Thank you, Kyle. That's Kyle Madura, WCAX reporter. When we come back, let's talk Father's Day for a little while. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate you spending a little bit of time with us. We started out the program talking about gun control. Is it needed? Are more pieces of legislation needed to pass to get guns under control in this country? Then we spoke with Kyle Madura, WCAX reporter, about the Norm McAllister trial up in Highgate being accused of sexual assault. Want to get to Father's Day because Father's Day is coming up, and I will not have a lot to talk, a lot of time tomorrow. We have a full slate of guests tomorrow, so I won't have a lot of time. I want to talk a little bit about that. But I also want to make sure that I answer or get your comments. And let's go to Jim in Barrie. Jim, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Mike. I generally support the notion that a victim of, or a possible victim of sexual assault and so forth is, I generally support not revealing their identity. And mm-hmm. I certainly agree with the sentiment of that. However, in the context of reporting on a trial, presumption of innocence is still paramount, and I think it's extremely prejudicial for a reporter, as the one CX just did, in the context of a trial, to refer to the accused as the victim. I just think at some point you have to move over to this is an accused, this is the accuser, and the person on trial is presumed innocent until proven otherwise, and that's the victim. To use that term, the victim, I think is very prejudicial. I just wanted to make that comment, and I'm sure it was not intentional on his part, but I thought that was worth pointing out.
Hey, Jim, thank you very much. Good point. In terms of making sure that we stay, we don't prejudice the case in this regard, that the evidence is what we go on. I do want to take a little bit of time. We can return to gun control either in this hour or in the second hour. But, you know, Father's Day is coming up. And I won't have a lot of time tomorrow to talk about this because we're going to be interviewing Joel Nashman about WDEV and the 85th anniversary of WDEV. And then Brian Gallagher, the general manager of the Vermont Mountaineers, about their terrific team. So I wanted to turn to Father's Day today. My question is this. What are the good qualities that you learned from your father? You know, I spent last night reflecting on this. You know, none of us are perfect, including our dads. And anyone who has raised children know the frustration, the anguish, the stress, the joy, the bliss, and the overwhelming sense of love you feel as a parent. My challenge for you, this thinking about this Father's Day, is to think of your dad and recall the very best lesson or experience you have of him and share it with us. You know, I did last night, and I think I've said this before, you know, Let me go through the thought process that I went through last night. I mean, and let me set it up for you because it's going to sound horrible at the first part of this, but I gleaned really good things in going through this thought process, and I would enjoy if you would share your experiences as well by calling at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. You know, alcoholism is a terrible disease. It not only affects the alcoholic, but it has a devastating impact on those that surround the person, including the family. And oftentimes it is the family that surrounds the person who's an alcoholic. You know, the lasting impact of the disease, however, you know what it does? It robs you of the memories of who that person actually is or might have been, absent this horrible disease. My father was an alcoholic, and he died at the age of 44. He drank himself to death. You know, it would be easy to focus just on that, to focus on his disease, to talk solely about the impacts of my father's alcoholism, how our family's downward spiral resulted in financial ruin, or how it just tore the family apart. Many could view his life as a failure because he couldn't overcome, he couldn't control his addiction. Certainly, if I think back at it, his full potential was never reached. You can't when you die at 44. But like other fathers, my father was a complex man, and dwelling on his failures obscures some of the successes, and he did have successes that he had. You know, like many Depression-era children, my father grew up relatively poor in Castleton, Vermont, and he began his career in the early 1950s as an auto mechanic. He never attended college, but he was a very, very bright man and believed that hard work mixed with the right kind of ambition would secure a more prosperous life for his family. And you know what? He was right. He rose to executive positions in local government because of his ability to gain the respect of those he met, especially those that worked for him. You know, as I was thinking about this last night, in retrospect, you know, he may have been tortured by his success because the more he succeeded, it seemed the more he feared failure. And I wonder how many people get themselves into that situation where the more they succeed, the more they fear failure, which meant if you fail, you let those people down that have placed their trust, their loyalty, their love in you. Ultimately, his fear seemed to consume him. And the drinking began, first socially and then constantly, until he just couldn't stop, although he tried several times. And ironically, the more he drank, the more he set his own course for his failure. But in his relatively short lifetime, he taught me some valuable lessons. He cared deeply about people and their circumstances. Maybe it had to do with his upbringing. Remember, and a lot of people during the Depression era had this sort of upbringing, but he had this ability to relate to those that were struggling or those who weren't given a voice in their life circumstances. Their opinions mattered greatly to him, and many times even more than those that were more fortunate in life or those who had power in life. I remember one life lesson in particular. I think I was in grade school, maybe third grade or so, when I accompanied him to a meeting where he was speaking with those that reported to him. And I was amazed that as the boss, he wasn't telling them what to do, but instead he was seeking their input and suggestions. You know, the vision that I had of a boss, it came completely from television at that age. You know, someone that barked orders. Sort of the, you know, I don't know, the Mr. Spacely from Spacely Sprockets or whatever it is. I don't know what the analogy is, but certainly, you know, those that barked orders. You know, I was confused because afterwards I asked him why he didn't just bark those orders. Why didn't he tell people what to do? And a life lesson here, because he explained you treat people the way you want to be treated. And he went on to say that you learn more by seeking diverse opinion, and in the end, people respect you. They respect you more as a leader because you listen to them. You ask them for their opinions. This was a complete reversal at a young age of what I thought a boss should do, what I thought a leader should do, because I've been watching way too much TV. And when I incorporated that life lesson into the way that I treated people, I think it's helped me in the end, and I appreciate my father teaching me that lesson. You know, my father's memory will be forever overshadowed by his addiction. But that doesn't mean that his legacy is overshadowed by his addiction, because his legacy isn't about his alcoholism, but rather those qualities of caring for others that he instilled in me. My only hope, and I hope I can do this, is that I'm successful in carrying out that legacy to future generations. You know, as you think about this, as a society, we seem to sometimes enjoy witnessing the failures of others. People aren't perfect. Neither are dads. But dwelling completely on their failures will often obscure the good. And the thing that I want to sort of emphasize this Father's Day is focusing on the good, especially in how it relates to our dads and how we can remember our dads or think of our dads. In fact, in a world where events sometimes makes little sense, and believe me, this past weekend, the past few days in Orlando, where people have been killed because of their sexual orientation or for their beliefs or for no darn reason at all, maybe it's healthy to think about what is good in our society and do that every day instead of just one day a year. I would be honored if you would call me and share stories about your dad. Your number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're talking about two subjects in this first hour. The first subject, I'm challenging you to think of your dad, because Father's Day is coming up Sunday, to think of your dad and recall the very best lesson or experience you have of him and share it with us. And I ask you to give us a call. I'd be honored to hear about your dad and your experience and the lessons that you learned from your dad. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I just think, given Father's Day, it's a sort of a nice touch for you to share with us, as I have done about my father, share with you the meaning of Father's Day and the lesson or experience you have of him. So give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. And we're also talking about gun control. We're getting a little bit into politics here in the first hour. And one of the things that I want to know is, what's your position on gun control? I had mentioned that the Rutland Herald wrote an editorial today that was very critical of politicians, saying the title of the Rutland Herald editorial was "Under Siege." It says that politicians have no guts, basically, to pass gun control legislation. They think that politicians and the gun lobby has created an atmosphere of hysteria around the idea of gun regulation, and the slightest compromise of the right to bear arms imperils the republic and the rights of man. And they conclude, what imperils the republic is carnage accounting to about 27 people shot every day. In 2 days, we exceeded the toll of Orlando. And it says the fear of politicians for their own political careers exceeds their concern for the lives of American people. And it concludes, Americans live under siege, and we have not found a way out. On the floor of the Senate, there was a filibuster. The filibuster was by Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut. Senator Leahy joined that filibuster and advocated for what he called common sense gun laws. He called for universal, effective background checks and regulating assault weapons. This is a quote from Senator Leahy. "I don't want to even think about how many Americans, though I do every day, have been killed," Leahy said. "I consider myself a responsible gun owner, but I think it's common sense that if we have assault weapons that are designed for the battlefield, they really have no place on our streets, in our schools, in our churches, or in our communities." And he went on to say, how do we respond to these Americans, thousands of Vermont, millions throughout the country, who say, what in heaven's name are you doing in Washington to make life safer for us? Leahy asked Murphy before yielding back to the Connecticut senator. And as you know, in a filibuster, one senator gets up, and we've always seen it in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but a senator gets up, you can yield your time to other senators. Leahy, the senator, Chris Murphy's time was yielded to Leahy, and that's what Leahy had said. So be very interested in your opinion. Do we need more gun laws in this in the United States? Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I found interesting, Paul Hines had, by the way, on the filibuster, there has been an agreement. The Republicans will bring up certain gun control items or legislation for consideration up to the full Senate. Whether they will pass or not, it's yet to be seen. Likelihood that they won't. One of the items I think that's being considered is whether somebody who is deemed or suspected of being a terrorist should be allowed to buy a weapon through a background check. So we're talking about Father's Day. We're talking about gun control. I know they're two separate things, but both of them are on your mind, or at least on my mind. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about Father's Day, and let's go to Lynette in Greensboro. Lynette, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi. This is probably one of the weirdest stories in my life, but it really happened.
Okay.
Back in 1970, I had just gotten out of junior college, and I joined a commune up in northern Massachusetts, second biggest commune on the East Coast, anyway. And very nice people, and we didn't do weird things and all that. But they sent us off. We had a summer camp so that we could concentrate on our spirituality, and they sent us up to Guilford, Vermont, and we took all these pieces of a wood stove, and we built the platform up on a hill, and it was very inaccessible. My dad was from Switzerland, my mom was from Johnson, and two landlocked countries or places. So they got along very well, but I was brought up outside of New York City in a very large town, Mount Vernon, New York. So my folks lived down there, and I was up in southern Vermont. When we were little, my dad, I can see us sitting on the couch, sitting around him. He would have his paring knife and a golden delicious apple and some real Swiss cheese, and he would carve us up pieces and hand them to us, and that was always one of the nicest times we had. He was at work all the time so that we could have a really good life. So anyway, so I'm up at this encampment, and it had belonged to an ex-slave, I believe. It was called Johnson's Mountain, Johnson's Pasture in that area, because it had been this man's farm. There were gooseberries growing, and I found a golden delicious apple tree in the woods. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there thinking about my dad. Well, my dad had fallen up some stairs at work and ripped his knee apart and could no longer do anything but flat ground. He couldn't go upstairs. He couldn't do anything like that. And I was sitting there thinking about golden delicious apples and my father, and I turned around, and my father was standing there, and this was on top of a mountain.
What a great story.
And he had found somebody at the bottom and said, my daughter is up there, can you get me up there? And they had like a four-wheeler or something, and they brought him up, and I was stunned, to say the least. It was just incredible.
What a wonderful story, Lynette. I really appreciate you sharing it. Let's go to Fred in Moncton Ridge. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Maybe I got the story wrong this morning. I thought you guys were talking about guns this morning.
We're talking both, Fred. We're talking about our fathers. We're talking about guns.
Well, just give guns to everybody. You know what I mean? That's what the NRA wants. They want every single American to have a gun. And they want most Americans to have three or four guns.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what everybody wants, let them have at it. Let them have right at it. And you're going to see carnage across this country like you've never seen. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Thanks, Fred. Thank you for your opinion. We're talking fathers. We're talking guns. Not necessarily connected here. I just brought up two issues that I thought were important for the day to bring up in the first hour. And, Lynette, I thank you for sharing your opinion. On the guns, I think, look, Congress is going to do whatever Congress is going to do, but if you think that it's going to change things, then I think you're mistaken. You know, we've been, assault weapons, politicians have been talking about assault weapons, and let's be honest, they aren't the military assault weapons. If they were the military assault weapons, I would be screaming that they be banned. They're semi-automatic weapons, and one of the things that, it's going to be interesting what happens in D.C. Let's go to Michael in Barrie. Michael, I only got about a minute. Can you make it real quick?
Oh, boy. I'll try, Mike. Years ago when I was working for the legislature, one of the members asked me to draft legislation dealing with gun control. And I don't remember the details of the legislation, but I do remember that a few days after it was sent to this person, I received a call from a vice president of the NRA in Chicago, and he said in very, very clear terms that if the sponsor pursued that legislation, that person's political career would end, that they would bring all of their power to bear and end it. So I got an early lesson about how the NRA operated. Another thing I'd like to quickly just mention is the Second Amendment, which I think an awful lot of people misunderstand, that any weapons are authorized by that amendment, and that just isn't true. For years, I don't ever remember automatic weapons ever being sanctioned in this country, and there are a multitude of weapons, you certainly as a Navy SEAL would know about that, that we're not allowed to have. So the Second Amendment is not a blanket amendment saying you can own anything. There are restrictions to it, and I think...
Michael, I have to sort of... I apologize. I have to cut you off. We're running out of time. You make some great points here. Give us a call back at another time, and maybe we can discuss it even further. Coming up, a check-in with Talk Media News, and then Kate Payne, social media branding expert. Topic of how to make yourself stand out for a job and for your business. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's this time in our program that we turn our attention to national issues. And on the line is our colleague, Bob Ney. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. One of the things that's happening in Congress right now is a filibuster, and that filibuster has ended. What's your take on this?
Well, it's ended. There's going to be a couple of votes, and this is what, you're going to see all kinds of amendments. There's going to be two basic amendments. And one will be, if you're on the terror list, you in fact cannot get a gun. If you're on the no-fly list, you in fact then can't get a gun, and there are major problems with both. It kind of tells me the Republicans weren't being, like, benevolent as much as they're going to say, okay, yeah, go ahead and put them forth, see what you get.
Bob, I had mentioned to our audience I was on the no-fly list at one point, and I had to go through all rigmarole to get off the no-fly list. I don't know why. Maybe because I'm on radio.
Well, Senator Ted Kennedy was on it. Civil Liberties icon John Lewis, who I serve with Congress. You know what they told him? He's African American. Carry papers. You know what he told them? That's what they do in South Africa.
Yeah.
Homeland Security. I would take you off the air with the Federal Communications Commission if I would tell you when I was a congressman what I actually would say unedited to Homeland Security. 78-year-old grandmother bakes cookies, et cetera, and every time the family wanted to go to Florida, grandma couldn't get on the plane from Ohio.
Right.
You know, it's just insane. So, what are, you know, if they have an effective list, sure. But this no-fly debate is just absolutely outrageous.
But what about the debate about a suspected terrorist being on the list? What's the counter to that? Because it seems reasonable.
Now, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
No, it seems reasonable if you on the face of it.
Well, it is, and I think that could be worked with. And I think that's what Trump's kind of working with the NRA. But having said that, here's the problem, and this just fries me. It's on my personal rant today. But, you know, they get this guy who they know, this killer Omar, and they know that he praised the buildings going down when he was in high school. Coworker after coworker gave them information. They get him there. And they say, what did you say all these statements for? And his father's publicly supporting the Taliban, going to Capitol Hill, right? And what do they do? Oh, okay, you were angry. Okay, yeah, you're a good guy. We'll take you off the list. So Senator Feinstein saying, well, you got to go back 5 years if you were on the terrorist list, because this would not have applied to this killer. It would not apply to Omar Mateen if this was in a law existing today. Wouldn't have applied to him. So they've got to start getting that right, too. You know, I don't know what you have to do. The father has pledged allegiance to the Taliban. He's running around America as we speak.
And that was the problem with the killer in Orlando, is that he purchased that gun legally, and the background check came back clean, even though he was visited by the FBI on a couple of occasions.
Right. And here's the genius of the Republicans and Democrats and president. I'll lump them in one bag. You know, the killer, San Bernardino, and his wife go to Saudi Arabia. They get a fiancé visa. They meet in Saudi Arabia. Everything's Saudi Arabia. They come through. And then once they kill everybody, we say, okay, well, if you've been to Iran in the last 5 years, you're not going to come into America with a visa waiver. In the brilliance of Congress and the White House, this is a bipartisan thing. Put them all in one bag, because what kind of solution is that? You know, going to after people who came in here from Saudi Arabia. So let's go after Iran.
You know, what I find fascinating in this whole debate, and we talked about this the other day, is that all these things that we're talking about, in my mind, they're not going to slow down the violence.
That's right.
And we don't go after the hard things that will slow down the violence. Because politicians like to do the easy things that don't make a difference.
I loved when they would not want to bring votes up. Republicans and Democrats are guilty. Not going to have that for a vote. You know, oh, my goodness, why get paid $185,000 a year to actually have to vote on things? Let's make it all easy so we don't have to cast a nasty vote. I mean, they don't get to the heart of where they should be on this stuff. They really don't.
Let's turn to – that's politics, but let's turn to presidential politics. Recent poll came out, says 70% of Americans view Trump unfavorably, 55% disapprove of Clinton. Are the Republicans getting nervous?
Well, they've always been nervous. A year ago today, Trump came down the steps of Trump Tower. They've been nervous since that. Well, they weren't nervous then. They all thought he wasn't going to make it. Now they got nervous. That poll also was done, I think I'm safe in saying, not after the violence in Orlando, which will have a effect on it. But here's the bottom line. It's early. A lot of people don't trust Donald Trump, and a lot of people don't trust Hillary Clinton. More don't trust him, but trustworthy factor, both of the. I mean, they almost ought to be running on the same ticket against somebody. They both have. He has more problems, but Hillary Clinton has severe problems, too. And it's going to be the most bizarre race of having two people that really, a vast majority of Americans at the end of the day, don't trust either one of them.
There was a USA Today news item that talked about many Sanders supporters don't want to give up. The some polls in recent months show anywhere from 25% to 50% of Sanders backers weren't ready to support Clinton. Experts, if you went on and read this, experts believe they will come home. What's your take?
I don't think a third of them. This is just a completely uneducated guess. I believe a third of them will go for the Libertarian candidates, I think a third. Possibly even more, depending on how Hillary Clinton handles this. Democratic great personal friends of mine who support Hillary Clinton have said things that you really don't want repeated about Bernie Sanders because they're so angry at him continuing. I argue that he is doing Hillary Clinton a favor.
How so?
If Bernie Sanders stops now and just says, okay, it's all over with, and doesn't try to fight for progressive issues in that platform, I promise you, as I sit here, 50% of his people will never support her under any circumstances. They may not go with Trump, but they won't support her because they have to win the progressive cause, and that's how this all started with Bernie. He's the icon of the progressive cause. And if he were to get out now, it would make it a little bit more comfortable for Hillary in the next, you know, 3 weeks. But I've got to tell you, in the long run, people would just say, oh, we got nothing. She's going to go against us. She's a neocon at heart. And we're just not going to have her. So I personally think he's doing her a favor.
One of the things that's going to be happening on Capitol Hill today is that the CIA chief is going to be on the Hill, and he's going to be talking about ISIS training for attacks on the West. I get that, and I understand that. My question is, what are we going to do about it? And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of analysis or strategy of what we're going to do about it.
I don't know how he's not going to get fired. Politically, I mean, he went so contrary to statements made by President Obama 2 days ago that I don't know where to begin. I was in shock in the sense that, you know, we're not really getting anywhere. Yeah, we've done this and that. I was in shock. I really was, because it went completely opposite of what the president said about how we're, you know, kind of winning this and that. Putting that aside, though, nobody wants to talk truth here. Nobody. The Iranians are going door-to-door with the Iraqis. If it wasn't for the Iranians, ISIS would have a flag above Baghdad. That is a fact of life, whether we like them or we don't, or whether they took our hostages or whatever. Russia and Iran's involvement with Assad is another issue. Assad is a bad guy, but if Assad wasn't there, ISIS would have a flag above Syria. So if we're really going to look at this, we have to tell Saudi Arabia to shut up. We have to tell Saudi Arabia, who helped create ISIS, to get out of the way. These Arab countries have to cough up money. We have to put aside differences of whether we like Assad, the Russians, or the Iranians, etc. And we've got to form a coalition that routs these people out. And we can't do it ourselves, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot of issues that, again, politically, everybody wants to kind of do a little tap dance.
Hey, Bob, as always, thank you so much for your expertise.
You.
I appreciate it. That's Bob Nay from Talk Media News. Up next, Kate Payne, and we'll be talking about social media. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have on the phone Kate Payne, who is a social media branding expert. And I want to talk to her today about how to make yourself stand out for a job and for your business. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. How can you not be fine on a glorious day like today?
I know, it's gorgeous.
Hey, why is making sure that your presence on social media important, Kate?
Well, it's very important because, as many of you may know, it's pretty noisy and chaotic on social media. So if you're trying to sell yourself on social media or make yourself stand out, you've got to try to find some pretty unique ways to do it to make yourself stand out amongst all that noise.
And is that why people hire you, to try to stand out amongst that noise? Because after you answer that question, I'm going to ask you how you do it. But
okay. Yes, that is why people do it, because I am helping people mostly from the side of business, certainly people who are job-seeking. And so, of course, the primary social media that are being used are Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And so I mostly focus on the LinkedIn side.
So let's talk about LinkedIn, because for most of us, you just sign up and you get on it and you sort of forget about it. So...
I knew that's what you were going to say. 99.9% of the people I talk to go, well, I have a LinkedIn account, and all these things pop up, and I don't know what the heck to do with it.
So what do you do with it? Because you're absolutely right. I believe most people are like myself. I signed up for LinkedIn, but I don't know what to do with it. I just signed up.
Well, and then the perception is, too, is that most people use it as a job-seeking tool. And so a lot of people think that if they've already... if they're a public figure, of which you are, Mike, if you're a business owner or a C-level kind of head of a company or a small business owner that maybe you don't need it. But LinkedIn's really changed in the last maybe year and a half, 2 years, with what it is trying to achieve for people so that it's more than a job-seeking tool. So it's really a place where you can brand yourself, regardless of what your mission is. I kind of equate it to, and maybe this is a poor analogy, but think about, you know, back in the day before the web existed, when you wanted to find somebody for a profession that they did, you went to the yellow pages in the phone book, right?
Mm-hmm.
and that's how you found somebody. This is kind of obviously the modern-day version. Also, one thing, too. Social media is really Facebook and Twitter. That's where you're social. That's where you put the pictures up of your cat. That's where you show everybody what you had for breakfast. That's where you talk about your children and all that stuff. LinkedIn is put in there with social media, but really LinkedIn is a professional networking site. It's really not social in the social media sense. Everybody lumps it in there. So yes, is it part of social media in the big picture? Yes. But it's really a professional networking site. It's a place where professionals should be. And it's also a place for job seekers.
So I was surprised, and I got to tell you, many people were, that Microsoft came in and scooped up LinkedIn for, I think it was $27 billion.
$26.2 billion. Don't you wonder how that .2 kind of came in there at that point?
What are they seeing in this that perhaps a lot of us aren't seeing?
Well, that's a good question. I was surprised as well when I heard it. And I was a little, and I'm leery. I'm cautiously optimistic that it may help some things. A lot of people have asked me my thinking on that. I think that, first of all, LinkedIn has become, and I'll get into this as I mentioned earlier, LinkedIn offers a lot more value than people realize, and I'll get into that from a personal branding standpoint. And I think more and more people are realizing that, and so across the world and even across the country, people are seeing the value if they're using it in a really strategic way. So there's that. Also, LinkedIn last year bought a platform, which some people may be aware of, called lynda.com, LYNDA.com, which is an online learning resource place, and it's huge. You can go and learn online courses for anything. And that was a standalone platform. It's a subscription-based service. I think you pay, if you want to be on it, you pay about $45 a month. You can learn anything. One of the reasons Microsoft wants it is that they can start using their courses. Like if you wanted to learn Excel, for example,
mm-hmm.
they can put a lot of their online courses on there to learn a lot of their Microsoft products. So that having Lynda is a big part of that LinkedIn piece. And not a lot of people are mentioning that. So lynda.com adds a big part of the value to the LinkedIn puzzle.
One of the things that you had mentioned is when we're discussing social media, we sort of lump LinkedIn in there, but it's a professional networking tool. What is the most common mistake people make? Let's stick with LinkedIn.
Okay. The most common mistake that people make is simply is they don't use it appropriately, and they ignore it. And once they ignore it, they just kind of let it sit there, and it doesn't do anything for them. So then they find it annoying. Then it gets spammy for them because they either don't accept invitations, they don't keep it current, and then they just kind of ignore it and it sits there and sort of gets moldy, if you will. So what I do with people is I say, okay, even if you're not going to engage, like let's say you, Mike, are maybe a big social media user and you don't feel you have the time for LinkedIn, so let's just start there.
Okay.
It would behoove you at the very least to at least go in there and really fill out your profile to have an engaging headline. So the headline is where most people put their job title. LinkedIn says as a best practice, don't use your job title anymore, because now LinkedIn, like Google, has become very search engine friendly. So when we talk about search engines, when you go into Google and you want to find something, an item you want to buy online, or you want to search for an individual or something in an industry that you want to learn about, you type in a search term, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or a keyword. LinkedIn has the same exact algorithm that Google does. So if you're going to go look for somebody who does something, they don't know that they're looking for Mike Smith. They might be looking for talk show hosts. They might be looking for the administration chief for the Jim Douglas administration. You are a Navy SEAL. They could be looking for somebody who like that. They could be typing in those terms. And they could not know that they're looking directly for you, but if they type in those terms, you could pop up. if your LinkedIn profile was up to date and enhanced. So the point is that you want your LinkedIn profile to have all those kinds of searchable terms that would make you pop up. Therefore, your profile needs to be rich. It needs to tell a story, your headline needs to be updated, and all of your experience sections need to be relevant and actionable.
Kate, we're talking with Kate Payne, a social media branding expert, but we're more into talking about LinkedIn and how that can help you. And Kate, you had mentioned that I view LinkedIn as sort of a job finding way, or social media in terms of job emphasis on job finding, but it's more on branding is what you're talking about. Is that correct?
Yes. So think of it as whether you're job seeking, if you're going in for an interview, you're selling yourself, right? Mm-hmm. You're selling yourself, you're selling your skills, and you're trying to get your career started, or you're continuing your career. If you're a professional and you're working for a company, and you've been in that industry for a long time, you want to develop your expertise. You may be totally happy where you're at, but you want to build yourself as that thought leader and expertise, and perhaps you want to go and be a speaker at a conference, or you want to build yourself as a peer within an industry. Perhaps you're a small business owner and you want to do the same kind of thing, build yourself as an expertise and a thought leader in the industry. Or you're a small business owner and you're trying to sell your widget or your service, and so you also want to become a thought leader and have sales, build sales. So ultimately, you're selling yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's your business or you yourself as an expert, you are selling yourself. So your brand equals your reputation. Your reputation are your skills, your personality, and your values. It's really that simple. So why not take that side of yourself, that brand, what you stand for, and bring that onto your LinkedIn? And that's a place where your story and your values and your skills can sit. It can be like a mini website for you. So a lot of people, of course, who own a business have a website, and there's an About Me page, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the About Me page will be about a little nugget about who they are, and then the website is about their company and all the things their team does and what their product is. But your LinkedIn page is really more than that. You can show samples of your work, you can show things that you've been on in the press, all kinds of things. You can show presentations you've done, articles you've been in, YouTube videos if you've been, interviewed on the news. It can be a whole host of things. You can show the volunteer things you've done, the boards you serve on. I mean, it's a place where you can really show that breadth of work, and it's appropriate that it's there. That's what people want to see.
Kate, we're going to take a short break. Can you stick with us for a little while? What I want to talk about when we come back is what are some of the common questions you get when you're talking about LinkedIn? We're speaking with Kate Payne, a social media branding expert, and we're talking more about LinkedIn today. We'll get into other subjects as well when we return. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Kate Payne, an expert in branding yourself and your company. And Kate, before the break, I sort of had mentioned, what is the most common question you get when people, you're the expert, people come to you and say, and let's keep with LinkedIn for a minute, what's the most common question you get?
Should I accept all the invitations I receive from everybody on LinkedIn?
And should you?
No, you shouldn't. LinkedIn would tell you otherwise, because they want you to, their goal is to get you to connect with everybody. No, you shouldn't. Take the moment to take a look at who's trying to connect with you. And there are certainly plenty of people out there, just like any social media, who are spammers, and some of them are even fake. Take a moment to take a look at them. If they don't look like they're relevant to you being connected with for your industry, reject them. They don't get a notice that says you rejected them. Some people think that you do. On the other hand, don't just accept people you know, because then you're not expanding your network. You're sort of just accepting your friends, and therefore you're not utilizing the platform to effectively.
And
so don't accept all invitations.
And most people are leery, aren't they, of accepting invitations?
Yes, but if you take a look at somebody's profile, you can take a look in less than a minute. Take a look, see where they're from, see what kind of industry they're in. take a look at their education. If it looks like they've got some recommendations from people and they've, you know, written things in clear sentences and it looks like they're pretty valid and their work experience looks good, you can scan that in 30 seconds and see if they're legit. Then go ahead and accept them if they seem relevant and within a peer group that you think makes sense for you. If they seem like they make sense, then there's no harm. I mean, the point is that you want to grow your network, because growing your network is helping to better your brand. It helps build your thought leadership. And as you post and engage on the platform, you never know if that's going to lead to more lead generation and sales, depending on your goals on LinkedIn. It might be a connection you could make if you're trying to find a job, relocate for something else, you know, and snowball.
We're speaking with Kate Payne, who is an expert in branding yourself and your company on social media. And we've been talking in particular about LinkedIn because it's sort of the professional online media that you use in order to sort of promote yourself. If you want to ask Kate a question, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'm learning a lot about LinkedIn, and everything that you have said that I should be doing, I'm not doing. So that's
well, I can share a couple other interesting little quick tidbits if you like, Mike.
Go right ahead.
A lot of people ask me is, basically LinkedIn's just basically an electronic version of my resume, right? Wrong. If you think that you should take your hard copy version of your resume and cut and paste it into your LinkedIn, you'll be doing yourself a huge disservice. While that was originally the case way back when, it is a very poor practice now. And recruiters now use LinkedIn 98% of the time. 98%, that's huge. Headhunters, recruiters, hiring managers use LinkedIn as much, if not more, than resumes. And actually what they are looking for, and I work with a lot of them, they will get their resume, and what they want to see now when they go to your LinkedIn profile, and they will, is if you have done a cut-and-paste version of your resume, they'll actually kind of ding you for that because they'll think that you're really not paying attention. They want to see a value add when they get to your LinkedIn. They want to see that you've worked hard to put a case study, to create something different. They want to learn more about you when they get to your LinkedIn profile that you wouldn't put on a resume or shouldn't. You know what I'm saying? A resume has a formula. LinkedIn is expected to have a value add. You're allowed to have something more there.
Let's go to the phone lines, and let's go to Brad in South Burlington. Brad, you're on open mic with Kate Payne.
Good morning. Question, I have a lot of competitors in my same field of business that ask me to connect with them,
mm-hmm.
and I hesitate to do that. Is there benefits or obstacles that I should be aware of?
That's a very good question, Brad. I work with a lot of people who are financial advisors who ask me that question a lot. And here is my answer. I work with actually financial advisors and realtors. So with financial advisors, I've always said, well, it's a subjective thing. So if you work with financial advisors, and if that was similar for you, if they're a really good friend of yours, then go ahead and connect with them. If they're a competitor and there is no reason for you to be connected with them, then I would say no, because then they would see who you're connected with. And they could see that those are people who might be your clients, and they would have complete access to your potential clients. They wouldn't know for sure, but they could assume it. And I will also tell you that some of the companies that they work for, the companies that they represent, will actually recommend to those financial advisors that they don't connect with their competitors for that exact reason. They can't require them not to. But that is considered a practice. So if you, if they're a good buddy and you feel like that's something that makes sense for you, by all means connect with them. That's a personal choice. But if it's somebody who's a direct competitor and they could see who you are connected with, then I would advise that you don't do that. And if they're offended by it, then that's their problem.
Hey, thank you, Brad, for your phone call. Let's go to Peter in Barrie. Peter, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, thanks. Interesting topic. I appreciate it. So I'm a book author, and how does that work? Does LinkedIn work for that kind of situation?
A book author, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you be a little bit more specific about your question? Do you mean like how you would want to represent yourself? And
well, would you recommend using LinkedIn because you're an author? I mean,
absolutely.
How would you? And so you would do the. I guess I'm sort of like Mike. I have a LinkedIn thing that I just ignore.
Okay. So as an author, first of all, there are a lot of authors on LinkedIn. So if you have an account, you could go into your LinkedIn account and look at to see what other authors are doing and how they're representing themselves on their LinkedIn profiles.
Oh, good idea.
So you could just do that as a starting point. So if you have your book, it's a great way to sell your book. You can also get involved in LinkedIn groups. I don't know what the topic of your book is.
It's gardening, yeah.
It's what?
Gardening.
Okay. So you could get involved in groups that are discussing gardening. You can also build your thought leadership by commenting on those groups. You can do that as frequently or as infrequently as you want to. Mm-hmm. You can list the website for your book. You can promote yourself. Promote yourself, though, in a way as a thought leader and expert, not necessarily being salesy about the book. People will find that on their own.
You're using a word I'm not sure. A thought leader? What do you mean?
Thought leader.
By that?
Well, you are a thought leader. So if you're writing about gardening, you're obviously an expert on gardening. I don't know your niche, but your thought leadership is your expertise.
Oh, okay. All right.
So thought leader is kind of a buzz term. Uh-huh. But it's LinkedIn is a great place to do that. Do you blog?
No.
Okay. If you did,
Peter LinkedIn is exactly like me.
You heard me thinking I should be, but I don't. Honestly, don't.
And so should I. I should actually practice what I preach. I actually do post every now and then. But LinkedIn has a feature, if you go in there, called Pulse.
Okay.
And it's essentially a blog feature.
Pulse, okay.
Yes. Yeah, and you can post articles there.
Okay.
And you can write between, 800 to 1,000 word articles, essentially a blog.
Uh-huh.
And it will automatically... post on your profile when you post something there.
Okay.
It's very what we call in social media sticky.
Have you heard of a program called Hootsuite, maybe?
Yes. Hootsuite is a social media manager, yes.
It's a social media manager. Okay, so if I did something in LinkedIn, can I then, through Hootsuite, forward it to the other places?
Yes. You're getting into a little bit of the weeds here from a technology scheduling standpoint.
But did you say the weeds?
Yes, you're getting into the weeds, so to speak, yes.
Well, see, how appropriate for a gardener.
And
I'm in the weeds.
Pun was not intended, but now that you mentioned it, yes.
Hey, thank you, Peter, for your phone call, and thank you for making me feel inadequate as well. So, Kate, let me ask you this. I went on LinkedIn, by the way.
Yep.
Went through your sort of profile, and you are a faculty member of the Honor Foundation. First, what is the Honor Foundation, and what do they do? And what's the Honor Foundation? Secondly, what do they do?
The Honor Foundation was founded about 3 years ago by a former Navy SEAL. His name is Joe Musselman. He was becoming a SEAL. He got injured, and they put him in an admin role out in Coronado to help retiring or injured SEALs to find work once they were transitioning out of their active duty role. And so he started realizing that here were these, elite warriors trying to get into the career, the civilian world to find employment, and were having a very tough time taking the skills that they had to find a really decent job in the civilian world. So that led to his passion for trying to develop a foundation where professional development programs could be put in place to help the special operations community transition. So anyway, he approached the Navy SEAL Foundation, who provided a grant to create the Honor Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation. The program started on the West Coast in San Diego in 2013, and they have faculty and mentors and coaches who work with, right now they've been mostly working with SEALs who are within 12 to 18 months in active duty, transitioning out of their active duty into civilian life. And they just started an East Coast curriculum, which just started this past January, which is based out of Virginia Beach. Mm-hmm. And I actually had been connecting online on LinkedIn in a group I'm on with in a LinkedIn group about professional world. And so I got connected with a guy named John DiNaggi, who you had on your program,
right,
now working at Norwich, who found me and said, oh, you should be in touch with this guy for the Honor Foundation. And he called me up and asked me if I would be interested in teaching LinkedIn to Navy SEALs on the East Coast. And so I was vetted, and so I just taught my first class last week in Virginia Beach, and they are going to probably be having me down in Virginia Beach about 5 times a year.
Well, that sounds like a great idea. I think, as you know, and you're familiar with the organization and with the community, that it is kind of difficult going from where you are to what you want to be once you leave the special warfare community. So thank you for doing that, and I'm glad that they are doing that because it is so needed. Kate, I want to thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. I want to thank you. Now I have so much homework to do because of what you said. I have to go back and, because I cut and paste and do everything that you told me not to do.
That's why I'm here, Mike. I can certainly help you out. You know where to find me.
That's right. Hey, by the way, Kate, where can we find you if we want to find you?
Well, my website is standingoutonline.com, and you can email me at kate@standingoutonline.com. You can find me through my website.
And on your LinkedIn account, right?
And on my LinkedIn account, which is... people can have a custom URL, custom website for their LinkedIn account, and you can find me on LinkedIn simply by going onto LinkedIn and typing in my name, which is Kate Payne.
Hey, Kate, thank you for your time.
P-A-I-N-E, sorry.
No,
it's
P-A-I-N-E, you're right. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Have a great day.
And same to you. That's Kate Payne. She's a branding expert for yourself and for your company. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We've got about 7 minutes left in the program. Want to make sure that I get to any phone calls on any subjects. We're going to sort of do a free-for-all Friday in 7 minutes here. So if you have a subject that is burning on your mind and you want to get to, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We started out the program talking about the politics of gun control and asked the question, should we have more legislation dealing with gun control? Should we control guns more effectively through legislation? Give us a call if you have an opinion on that. We switched to Father's Day and talked a lot about the fact that Father's Day is coming up, and I'm not going to have the opportunity to address it tomorrow. We got a jam-packed show tomorrow, jam-packed program tomorrow, so won't have a chance to talk about it. But in summary, I think it's a good thing on Father's Day to think about the good of our dads and what needs to be remembered in terms of what legacy they have passed down to us, and if it's important enough to pass down that legacy to others. And certainly if you have any reflections on your dad that you want to share with us, we got about 5 minutes left. Give us a phone call. I'll try to get you on the air, 802-244-1777, or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Couple of other things in the news that I just want to go over and ask the question, because I've got a lot of stuff here that I want to get to. There's a Kaiser study, a study by the Kaiser Family Foundation that has found that Vermont has highest health care insurance premiums out of the states that they polled. And what the headline is basically middle-aged Vermonters pay higher prices than 13 other states for health insurance through the state's online marketplace. And the prices will continue to go up if state regulators approve new rate hikes proposed by insurers. And the rate hikes that are planned to go up are Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is asking a rate hike of 8.2% in 2017, and MVP has asked for an average rate hike of 8.8%. Those hearings will begin. And that's coupled with something that I read in the Burlington Free Press. That was in Vermont Digger talking about the Kaiser report. But in the Burlington Free Press the other day was a report that says you need $21 per hour to afford Vermont rent. And in Burlington, it's actually higher. It's $26 per hour to afford Vermont rent. And I'm combining these two articles, and I'm asking the question, is Vermont becoming unaffordable, an unaffordable place to live? And we won't have enough time to get into that, but I am curious what your thoughts are. And lastly, well, I got two other things here I just wanted to go over, and I did with Bob Ney a little bit. Trump is at 70% of Americans view him unfavorably. Does that have the Republicans nervous? Now, 55% disapprove of Clinton as well. So they're both upside down, and we've talked about this on occasion. The American public, this is not going to be an election about who is the best candidate or who is the most like. It's going to be who's the least objectionable. And right now that is Hillary Clinton, who stands at 55% disapprove of Hillary Clinton. Just to give you a matchup in this poll, Hillary Clinton is at 49%. Donald Trump is at 39% when they go head-to-head. And also for all the Bernie supporters that are out there, and there are many of them, you call in here all the time. One of the quotes that I heard from one of the Bernie supporters, and many Sanders supporters don't want to give up. Recent polls show that anywhere between 25% and 50% of Sanders backers aren't ready to support either Hillary Clinton as the nominee. One of the tweets that I picked up on is, "We'll never stand down," tweeted Women for Bernie on Sunday. "It's not over." And my question is, isn't it over? And it's interesting, you know, thought process in terms of what is going through. Bob Ney, for example, says Bernie shouldn't get out. And actually, he's helping Hillary Clinton by not getting out, because what he's doing is making sure that those that don't feel they're being heard, that those that feel that the progressive agenda will be forgotten, can sort of, Bernie is making sure for them that that is remembered and the agenda is implemented, at least in some form, in the platform of the Democratic Party. I want to thank our guest today, Kyle Madura, WCAX reporter. We've been talking about the Senator Norm McAllister trial, and also Kate Payne, a social media branding expert. And we learned a lot through Kate, at least I did. And, of course, all of you. Thank you for your phone calls. Tomorrow, Joel Nashman, and then Brian Gallagher, President General Manager of the Vermont Mountaineers. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at HBinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.